Not yet. Now.
Good evening, Hoops HD fans. I'm Joby Fortson, and I'm your host while our friend Chad Sherwood is taking a little leave of absence. Wait a minute, he might... I might be wrong.
I got him here.
He might actually be there.
Yeah, he's behind me. A picture of him, anyway.
I think that's the first time we've had multiple correspondents in the same room.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, what I don't understand is why I'm not... I should be hosting every week anyway, but without Chad, I don't know why it's Joby and not me. I never understood that.
Well, who else is going to talk about the wonders? We need to go to you to talk about Missouri, Kansas.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was supposed to be our main topic last week, but then I was told, after we didn't get to it, that there's no time this week either. When are we going to talk about it?
Not at all. Well, before we go into the topics, why don't we start with the puppet master himself, David Griggs.
All right. Well, yeah, that's me, the puppet master. I'm just happy to be here.
Joining us, John. John, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing quite well, Joby and David.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is Chad behind me, so there we go.
Summer is the slow season, but there still is basketball news out there. Many things, you know, what has particularly taken an unusual turn is the number of late coaching maneuvers and coaching decisions. And I thought we'd start by talking about some of those, one that we didn't get to last time, the whole changeover in Austin, Texas. Shaka Smart is in, and Rick Barnes is out, but he finds himself back in Knoxville. What was your thought on that, John?
Well, it seemed inevitable that Shaka Smart was going to move on from VCU, but I suppose the resources were there at Texas for him to take Havoc to the next level. But then we find out later on that Havoc had been trademarked by VCU, so he's not going to be able to take that brand with him to Texas.
Right. And they hired a really good coach. I mean, the guy from UTC that they hired, if I was better at this, I would have the name at the top of his head, but he's yeah, thank you. He's a former VCU assistant. I thought he did really well at UTC or Chattanooga, as they like to be called. I think he'll do well at VCU. I'm not going to say that there's not going to be a rough transitional period, but I think VCU will continue to remain relevant and at or near the top of the Atlantic 10. This is a great hire by Texas. Shaka Smart is an outstanding coach, and he gets all aspects of it. He doesn't just win, but he connects with his players, he connects with the fans, and he builds the program. He's a great ambassador for the game. I guess the term rock star coach comes to mind, but he is a really good hire. And with that, I guess we'll get to this in a minute, but considering Tennessee's track record with Bruce Pearl and Ronnie Tindall, what exactly has Rick Barnes done wrong? Because he has to have done something, otherwise Tennessee would not be interested.
Well, it is, you know, I had the enjoyment of seeing Rick Barnes up and close. Little known fact, he almost was hired to be Virginia's head coach when he was at Providence back in the day.
Wow.
Instead, Virginia went inside. The contract was evidently signed, almost. It was like the signing deal, but someone at UVA leaked it. Barnes got so angry, they refused to actually follow through with the deal. And so they had already told Gillen, who was at Xavier at the time, and Calhoun at Connecticut, sorry, we're going to go with Barnes.
Wow.
They did the worst thing you do on a hire ever. So I'm actually very familiar. Then he goes to Clemson, et cetera. Barnes, I think, could really thrive in Tennessee because Tennessee, typically, while they've had some good players here and there, they actually need to be the type of team that slows it down, that plays ugly basketball. And Barnes, very few can play ugly basketball like Rick Barnes. I think he will actually be competitive. The SEC has been down. A strong system-ish play might actually do well, especially in that part of the conference. I mean, Kentucky and Florida will still be the dominant teams, but Tennessee could eke out enough wins to get into the NCAA tournament from time to time.
Yeah, Rick Barnes, I'm curious to get your take. We love making fun of Rick Barnes here at Hoops HD. I don't think he's a great coach, and you might die of shock, both of you, when I say this. I don't think he's bad. I think he's good. He had some really good years at Texas. He went to a Final Four at Texas. He won at Clemson. Like, Clemson was pretty awful before he got there, and he turned them into a tournament-caliber team that was in the rankings. I mean, I don't know who to really compare them to now, but I'm thinking more along the lines of a Northwestern or a Mississippi State, where they currently are. I know Mississippi State's been really good before, but they were not good at all when he got there, and they were good when he left. So he has some merit on his resume that I guess because when you're at Texas...
They were Virginia Tech, let's be honest.
Yes, they were Virginia Tech. That's a fair way of putting it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I guess when you're at a place like Texas, which I think, I don't know if it's Texas or Ohio State, but it's in the top two or three largest athletic departments as far as resources and spending, I guess they just figure that if you're not in the top 10 and going to the Final Fours on a regular basis, which he wasn't, then you're not doing well. It's not the first coach that's won big and been let go because they were winning but not winning enough. And it's not the only sport, so...
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, David, in a lot of ways. Texas is number one, and it's number one by a lot on resources, all the way down, you know, all the way down to the swimming program. It's not a basketball school. Football's king, and that goes without saying. So you're always going to be playing second fiddle. The facilities, I know the interior, they've pumped up the Irwin Center a little bit, but it's still one of the ugliest, worst designed basketball arenas out there. It doesn't necessarily get loud because the acoustics are bad. It's dark. It feels empty even when it's full. There's always going to be an issue to a degree with Texas basketball. Shaka Smart might be able to overcome that and actually push it because I think we're all big Shaka fans, but I'm not going to hang too much on Rick Barnes here. I think you're right. I actually am in agreement. I think he is a good coach, not great. Good coach, and like I said, he delivers a system, especially on the defensive side of the ball, that maybe without, you know, the trying to maybe the talent that he actually had at Texas with Ford, etc., may have messed up on trying to redo that model over and over again. Who knows?
Well, one thing that's interesting is at least Texas got their man, Alabama. They made a run and threw everything but the kitchen sink at Greg Marshall, but they were not able to wind up with him. Wichita is able to re-sign Marshall, and Alabama winds up hiring Avery Johnson instead.
Now, okay, I'm not much of an NBA guy, so I don't really have a strong opinion. It's not who I would have gone after, but maybe it's a good hire. I really thought Greg Marshall was the best choice. They didn't get him. Here's the difference between college and pro basketball. In pro basketball, you're more manager than coach. Is that fair to say? I don't think you're doing teaching drills. You're not teaching NBA stars how to post up and doing the one-on-one drills the way you're coaching and teaching in college. The skill sets are different. Avery Johnson was a good NBA coach, but is that because he was a good manager? Will he be good in college? Can he go in the homes? Can he recruit? Can he build a system that doesn't kind of come to him through drafts and free agency and things like that? And can he teach? Because coaches really are kind of teachers at the college level, whereas, well, in baseball, they're not even called coaches. They're just called managers. I don't know if this is fair to say because I don't watch enough NBA, but aren't coaches pretty much just managing the game? Isn't that a much bigger part of it than it is at the college level?
I would agree. Some don't. But like, you know, Rick Carlisle in Dallas, for instance, Popovich, I think they have some of that, for lack of a better word, teaching component that you talk about. Avery Johnson, like most NBA coaches, probably was more manager. I did get to see him coach up close. But the measurement I usually take is defense, and his teams did play defense. That's almost what you do have to teach in the NBA in a lot of ways, because many times you have a bunch of superstars who never had to play defense in college. And so I don't think it's an awful fit as far as, but it's, you need to see how it plays out. The key element that it was not talked about was that Avery Johnson actually has ridiculous AAU connections. I had no idea until I started reading up on it. And I actually think recruiting's not going to be too much of an issue for him. I think he will get the kids he's supposed to get. He will be able to get into the homes. He's very personable, if you've ever seen him. And so this could turn out to be a good hire, but your note of caution, David, is the one that I'd still attach to it, and we'll see how it plays out.
And Alabama's interesting. You know, having spent some time in Alabama, it is a football school, but they're excited when the basketball is good, and they almost resent that it's not. And what I found, as funny as this is, and this is just my own theory, claiming to be a football school is, they say that because it is, but I think they almost say that as a defense mechanism because of how underaccomplished they were in basketball. You might recall, like, the years they went to the Elite Eight and the years when they were in the top 25, they were sold out every game. It was a huge deal. They were really excited. Now they're saying they're a football school just because it's almost easier not to care than it is to acknowledge they're not really good. But all those people saying, well, they could be good and it wouldn't matter, I think it would matter a lot. I think the fans would get behind this team huge if Avery Johnson started winning.
They sell out, and this sounds funny, but it's true. They sell out gymnastics.
Yes.
I mean, you know, if Alabama will support a winner, if a winner's in basketball, that, though, I will say, they are definitively a football school.
Yes.
Without a doubt. I mean, Bear Saban, that they're going to be, they are a football school, but they, I think they'll give the requisite support of a strong basketball, but they're never going to be even a balanced school. Yeah, I'm not saying they'll ever be Kentucky, but I don't even think they'll be Florida.
And they're certainly not going to play second fiddle to Auburn and Bruce Pearl, who's going to be in the second year of his rebuilding project.
Yeah, when Auburn hired Bruce Pearl, I think, do you think that really perked Alabama's ears up? Like, we need to make a big hire of our own in basketball.
I think so. I definitely think so. But likewise, I think that football school component, that was a factor, not the factor, but a factor in the Marshall decision in the first place. That and over $3 million at the program that he had helped build and could basically live the rest of his life out.
Right.
as the man.
And he has done so well at Wichita. I for one, am glad to see, as someone that, as you know, supports teams from outside the Power Five, I'm glad to see someone build a top 15 caliber program and stay there. I think Wichita would have continued to be successful without him, but he has certainly been a big part of why they're so good. I mean they've been good before. You know, they had been to a Sweet 16, they'd had a couple good years previously, but since he's been there, they are a consistent top 15 caliber program.
And the Valley needs him. Yeah. I know it sounds funny. The Valley as a whole needs him because there are going to be schools that bubble up and bubble down. I mean, Northern Iowa bubbled up very rightfully and deservedly so last year.
Mm-hmm.
But who's to say who the next one is? I don't think Northern Iowa is going to be there forever, for instance.
I don't think they're going to be there this year.
Yeah.
Really.
I think Wichita State is going to be consistent.
Oh, they will. Yeah.
Yeah. And in that legitimate top 25 discussion year in, year out.
I'm sure Chad will also be mentioning Evansville for future Under the Radar podcast this upcoming year.
I don't like complimenting Chad, but he spotted them prior to last year. And I think Evansville will be good next year. Now, I don't know if they'll be Northern Iowa good, but they might be inside the bubble good. I mean, they're a team to watch, but you're exactly right, Joby. Other teams are kind of cyclical. They kind of go through cycles, and with Northern Iowa, again, losing a lot of their star talent to graduation or whatever, they're sort of starting over. But The interesting thing about the Valley is that a lot of teams do that, and after 2 or 3 years of retaining the same players, they're able to play at a high level. I think Evansville will be good this year.
Well, on that note, of teams that lost some talent but retained talent and come up, we had an announcement over the last month. Bo Ryan is going to be going on his farewell tour, so to speak, this time around. John, what do you see for the future of the Wisconsin program and the impact that the announcement early will have on Wisconsin's season upcoming?
Well, we still have yet to see a hire, to my knowledge, of their coach in waiting or future head coach. But Wisconsin has been one of the more consistent programs going back to 2001 when he was hired. They've had two Final Four appearances, including one national appearance. They have one of the strongest home court advantages in the country. I don't think it's going to be at the same level immediately after he retires, but they're still going to be near the thick of the Big Ten and national races once Ryan does retire following this season.
Do you think that Greg Gard will be the coach of Wisconsin for 2016-2017?
Ooh, good question.
I don't know if it's going to be Gard myself because I'm not in as much as in tune to the Big Ten as some of our other colleagues would be.
I don't know. I'm guessing it will, but I think they'll look at other people. And one guy, I never understood why Ben Jacobson hasn't gotten more looks. I mean, I know he's gotten looks, but he's always kind of stayed put at Northern Iowa. They look a lot. The only reason I think that he would be a great fit at Wisconsin, I think he's a really good coach who has similar philosophies and plays a similar style of ball. I think it would be a very smooth transition. But who are your candidates when you're talking about, besides Gard, when you're talking about replacing Bo Ryan at Whiskey?
Also keep in mind, Bo Ryan also came from the Wisconsin system. I think it was UW-Platteville where he was originally hired.
Zachary. Yeah. And obviously, you know, as the local Virginia guy, the nervous Nelly situation is always has been as, well, if Bo Ryan retires, is that when Virginia loses Tony Bennett? Does he go home?
I don't see that. I think Tony Bennett has Virginia to a point to where any move is a lateral move, with the exception of Kentucky, you know, Duke, something like that. But I don't know. Does he? Does he go back? Is that in his wheelhouse? Does he want that job? Or is he happy where he is?
In the family situation, from what I understand, the family situation, you know, where his kids are, et cetera, makes it an unlikely situation, from what I understand. But I don't, you know, it's not like I've talked to him.
Well, you need to.
Well, I need to, we need to make sure. Yeah, I still think it's a crime that Mike London, the head coach of the football team, who has done, I actually like Mike London personally a lot, but he has not done the best job on the field. He's paid somewhere in the neighborhood of half to a full million more than Bennett. I just still don't know.
And another interesting choice, I realize that he's only in year two of his current job, but had Milwaukee lost the Bucks, and had and if Buzz Williams has a big year and goes back to Wisconsin, will Marquette explode? Like, will it just, like, sort of blow up, you know, a Chernobyl-style explosion?
That would be a very interesting situation because obviously last year that we knew they were going to take a step back, or at least I was fully expecting. That was a real step back. I mean, that didn't look like, oh, we're rebuilding for the future. That looked like a mess.
Yeah.
To me. If you've seen the non-conference schedule for Marquette, it doesn't sound like they're going to be immediately competitive this year.
Marquette's non-conference schedule, since you brought it up, is amazing. It consists of, you know, I think it has four or five solid programs that you would expect to see in the rankings. And then it has, it's like they're playing top 25 and bottom 25 and screw the other 300 teams in between. It is incredible how good, but yet how awful their schedule is.
Yep, they've got NCAA tournament teams and Centenary Award teams.
Many.
Grambling and San Jose State are two of the the Centenary level teams.
Yeah, they're playing the two. Oh, wow.
They just really like Poison. I mean, they know more Poison than Brett Michaels right now with the RPI Poison they're going to be drinking.
Yeah, because the good teams they're playing probably aren't winnable games. They're not very good. And the crap teams they're playing are crap. I mean, you didn't even schedule an NIT caliber team that would at least look halfway decent. So they are going to be absolutely worthless going in the conference play.
And this is a program that already lost to Omaha last year.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it who knows if something like that sort of thing could happen again. Before we jump off the coaching component, you to tail on what Dave, you were talking about on with Avery Johnson going from NBA to college, we have obviously a very well-known situation of college to NBA with Fred Hoiberg. How do you think Hoiberg will be able to go forward in the reverse action from Johnson?
Well, I'm sad to see him go. We should have talked about this last week, but we forgot. Chad, our host, just didn't get around to it, nor did he get around to what was supposed to be our main topic, I might add. But I love what Fred Hoiberg did at the college level. I enjoyed him as a player. I remember him as a player at Iowa State. And he went into a program that was kind of broken and turned them into a huge success, back-to-back Big 12 tournament championships, earning a 3 seed 2 years in a row. So you're talking top 10-ish 2 years in a row in the eyes of the selection committee. I know they had an early exit this year, but he did a sensational job. And I just hate to see a good coach leave the college game. Now, and again, I think a lot of coaches that go from college to the NBA fail for the almost inverse reason we talked about earlier. In college, they're the stars. Coaches are the stars, like Tom Izzo, John Calipari. They're the stars. In the NBA, they're not. I think Brad Stevens understood that. I'm not sure that John Calipari did or Rick Pitino did or any of those others that tried to jump up and didn't do well. Does Hoiberg understand that? Probably. The one thing that he did is that he was an NBA player, so he has a frame of reference that a lot of other successful college coaches who have bombed in the NBA do not have. But it's a different game. It's all basketball. You're not recruiting. You don't really have control the way you do in college. Like, you can't set curfews. You can't really make the rules. You're basically just managing the basketball game. I think he's a good bench coach. I could see him doing well at the NBA level.
Well, Rick Pitino did have some success when he went from Providence to the New York Knicks.
Yeah.
His first season, I believe they were an 8th seed in the Eastern Conference. And then the following year, they won the Atlantic Division but lost to the Bulls in the second round of the playoffs.
Yeah, but wasn't that before he was a big star?
Big star at Kentucky.
Yeah.
But this was after his first Final Four coaching Providence in 87.
Yeah, he did. Okay, so maybe that's not the best example. But I just think that college and pro are different, and some are cut out for one and not the other, and some can do very well at both levels. We'll see how he does, I guess.
Well, one coach that seems to be not on top of his game lately, according to his own fan base, is we turn an eye towards the Memphis Tigers. Josh Pastner.
Steve Plum from Murray State to Iowa State, I do like that hire. I think he'll do well there.
Oh. Right.
But, yeah, getting back to what you were saying.
Yeah, Pastner is his program is under fire right now at Memphis. What really came out of the Memphis situation recently leads to a larger topic of transfer rules. Austin Nichols, who was a 5-star recruit that Pastner got, after 2 years decided, you know, averaging only about 11.5 points a game, decided, hey, I think I can do better for my NBA career, etc., somewhere else. And Memphis's reaction was like, well, we mentioned Bo Ryan earlier, was very Bo Ryan-esque. it was, we're going to, first they wouldn't grant it. And you can't, it's really tough to just say no in today's line. But then they did what a lot of schools are trying to do, which is, okay, we'll give you a normal transfer, but here's a list of schools that you cannot go to. And it usually involves future opponents and that sort of thing. And the Nichols family looked at the list, evidently, and said, no. There was a big standoff, and finally Memphis relented. But after the Nichols family hired a lawyer, threatened suit, would have maybe even brought down the whole transfer system. So, in the present situation, we talked about the graduate transfer issue last time. What about just regular transfers and the limitations that schools presently can put on those who want to transfer? What do you see the future as far as just regular transfers and how they will be handled? Do you see changes coming in either behaviorally or by the rules?
Well, looking at the future, I hope so. Looking at the present, it's utterly ridiculous. For starters, what those limitations are, and sorry if this is overly elementary, when you sign with a school, the scholarship is basically a working contract that gives the school you're signing with certain rights, and one of them is that you cannot transfer anywhere that you are not released to. If you do transfer there, you are not eligible to practice, play, or receive aid. So you can't, like, say Tennessee was on the list of schools that he was not allowed to transfer to. If he were to say, you know what, I'm going to go to Tennessee anyway, he would not be allowed to work out with them, practice with them, or receive aid. He would have to pay his own tuition for one full year, and it would be a year off of his clock before he would be eligible to receive aid and play for them. That's absurd. To me, I think that's just way too much that they can control where you can and can't go when you're not even going to be playing for them anymore. The other thing, and we all know this, is that even if you are released, you must sit out a year, which burns your redshirt year, and if it's your second time transferring, it burns a year of eligibility. Not all sports have that. In fact, most don't. There's 30-something NCAA sports. The only ones that have that rule are men's basketball, women's basketball, football, ice hockey, baseball. Am I missing any, John?
None that I can think of.
Okay. And you know what sports have the highest transfer rates? Those, the ones with the rule. And the reason why the transfer rate is so high in college basketball is it because in this situation the student wanted to leave. Okay, fine. In most situations, not all, but I would say 70% easily, a player transfers because the coach forces them out. The transfer.
Now, go ahead.
Not in this case, but if we're talking the transfer rule in general, I do not like at all that a kid can be forced out and be prevented from going to where he wants to go, and even if he is allowed to go there having to sit out a year. I think it's outrageous. The transfer rate is over 40%, and one of the reasons it's so high is because I think coaches can – isn't because kids are allowed to transfer and do what they want, because in those sports, the transfer rate's even lower. I think the transfer rate is high because a coach knows – that even if he forces a kid off the team, he still can control where he does and does not go. I think that's stupid. I think that's absurd. It's got to change. It's got to change. When I look at the future, I don't think that it will, but it has to.
Well, there is some change that's coming about because we're also talking about one-year renewable scholarships. There are a couple of conferences that are starting to move towards four-year scholarships. I believe the Pac-12 is the first one that's going to be going in that direction.
Yeah. So, I mean, and there is that, which, to John's point, that would prevent a coach from being able to force a kid off the team.
Yeah, and that, you see, I'm I'm glad John brought up that, because that's been something that I personally have always wanted to see. Because it should be a two-way contract, period. Yeah, right now is very one-sided. It should be a two-way contract. That affects both transfer, but also in the case of injury. I'd like to see provisions. Often you see kids either injured or they were not their eligibility is up and they still have classes time. I'd like to see the six-year clock. I think Arkansas, for instance, has a pretty
good. It's a five-year clock, by the way.
But Arkansas, I think Arkansas is a six.
I misunderstood what you were saying. Yeah. It's a five. Essentially, the NCAA gives you 5 years to play four seasons.
Right. For playing. What I'm saying.
But a school can. It could be 12 years.
If the school upon wants. Themselves yeah. to recognize, hey, you could still come here, mm-hmm. and we're going to give you more time to get your. To be able to get a degree so you can have a life after the sport, after you played. And that's why I mentioned Arkansas. Arkansas was the first to do that. I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago. And I don't know how many others have adopted that.
Most will let you finish your degree. If for no other reason, they get the APR point once a player graduates. Yeah. It's very common if someone leaves to be a professional 3, 4, 7, 10, however long it is later, for the school to let them come back, and they'll still pay for it. And once you've exhausted your eligibility, meaning whether you've played four seasons or been there 5 years, it doesn't count as a scholarship against the team. That's one of the few rules the NCAA has that's actually good. Anyway.
One issue that's in the news right now, greater than basketball. Bigger than basketball, but actually does have a basketball and NCAA generally issue, is in the wake of the awful tragedy in South Carolina. The Confederate flag became an issue yet again. And the reason why that has relevance to the NCAA is that there are states, Mississippi, South Carolina, as long as the Confederate flag was displayed,
at the state house.
In case of Mississippi is part of the state flag.
Yeah.
They could not host for right now. They could not host NCAA tournament sanctioned events unless they were the home team in a tournament sort of situation.
That stipulation is very new. Yeah. And it wasn't until very recently that they could host if they were the home team. They were just SOL before. But, yeah, for predetermined events, like for the round of 64 and 32 for the men's NCAA basketball tournament, which are all at predetermined sites, South Carolina and Mississippi were not allowed to host them. The reason being that the Confederate – well, okay, it's not the Confederate flag. It is the – Army of Virginia's battle flag or the Confederate Navy's, mast, whichever one you prefer, was displayed at the state houses. But with it coming down, South Carolina taking it down, they are now eligible to host NCAA tournament events. So, go ahead.
I think there's a good chance that Columbia is going to be hosting one as a neutral site in the NCAA tournament. Beyond just the women, the outstanding women's basketball team hosting it, as it naturally would.
You have to go back to 2002, the last time, I think it was in Greenville, where South Carolina had held a regional. I don't know any place in Mississippi that would be suitable to host an NCAA regional, maybe in Biloxi or somewhere along the Gulf Coast. That's a separate topic.
And while the Robert Trent Jones Golf Circuit is in Alabama, this applies to all sports. So, I don't know if there's a great golf course in Mississippi that could host a region, for instance. I don't know. But now at least they'll be able to do so.
Right. And
what are your general thoughts on what the rule was before it got wiped away? What were your general thoughts on the NCAA's thinking in the first place? David, I know you've had some thoughts in the past on it.
Well, one of the things I didn't like was, regardless of what your political opinion is on the flag, and I respect the people that are offended by it, I understand it. One of the things I didn't like are that kids that had absolutely nothing to do with why the flag was being displayed at the State House were essentially being punished. As a world sports fan, as a world soccer fan, I think that if a team does well enough to earn a seed and earn a right to play either at home, as is the case in women's basketball, baseball, football for your FCS tournaments and whatnot, or in the case of the NCAA basketball tournament, if you're allowed to play close to home, then you should be allowed to do so, and you shouldn't be disqualified because your leaders, who you don't even know and will never meet and you have no control over, decide to display a flag. So I did not like the rule, because that is one of the reasons I did not like the rule. I don't want to sit here and say that I do not support anyone that stands up against what is ultimately a symbol for segregation. But I don't like, I think that they were kind of punishing the wrong people.
I guess some of my other thoughts would be, we knew about Mississippi and South Carolina, but also to a lesser extent, I think there was also a Confederate flag removal somewhere in Alabama that was also going largely underneath the radar.
That's a very good point, and I do not know the answer to this. Joby, maybe you do. Alabama flew a Confederate flag at the State House, yet was allowed to host NCAA events. Yet
they had it. They didn't have it on the State House. They had it on the grounds in a memorial area.
Oh, okay.
But the governor, and probably smartly, the governor just, in the wake of the South Carolina instance, the governor just took it upon himself and said, I don't care, we're taking it down. Yeah, I'm not dealing with this, you know. And it was probably, in my opinion, an extremely wise move, both politically, but also, you know, I'm a little more sympathetic, I guess, to those who find offense in the flag. And it kind of stems a little bit from what you said earlier, David. This is not the Confederate flag that flew over Montgomery, Alabama, and Richmond, Virginia during the Civil War.
No.
Except late in the war, very late in the war it did. But but this is really the Army battle flag. And which, you know, people don't, you know, yes, you see some "Don't Tread on Me" from the Revolutionary War days. You know, people usually don't choose when they're the battle flag on things. As such, this wasn't, I had less sympathy for the, oh, this is about our traditions, this is about our culture, because those that really grasped the flag initially were not those who served their state in the Civil War.
Correct.
It was the segregationists in the 1940s. That's when it first popped up.
Yes.
It was almost used as a weapon of racial divide. And right. So I get exactly why, in this instance in particular, why such stringent rules came down. I mean, I'm not in favor of PC movements. You know, they usually drive me nuts. But in this case, I actually could see they were, it's almost, I'm offensive because I want to be offensive. And I want to actually hold a symbol. It's not about the Confederacy, really, in its core heart. It's not about the Southern culture. Maybe I know a lot of people view it that way, maybe now. But really, the genesis of this was segregation and racial divide. And so that's why I'm a little bit more sympathetic to the NCAA.
Right.
I guess, gosh,
could I give a brief
to say that coming out of my mouth.
Could I give a brief history as I understand it? Because the ignorance on this is, I think the ignorance on this offends me more than the actual ideological racism. It doesn't, but just to make a little bit light of it, it does. That's not the Confederate flag. The Confederacy had three different flags. That was never one of them. The last one that you mentioned had that design in the flag, but it wasn't the flag itself.
Right. Right.
That was, in its square form, the battle flag of the Northern Virginia, and in its rectangular form, it was the Confederate naval flag. That was the only time you ever saw it during the Civil War. Once the Civil War was over, I don't think Robert E. Lee was ever in South Carolina at any point in his life, and at the end of the Civil War, South Carolina wanted to secede from the Confederacy. So, to unpack all of that, you are flying what you are mistaking for the Confederate flag, but isn't actually the Confederate flag on your state house, you know, to remember a country that you wanted to leave to celebrate your history.
It was also another time in the 1820s or 1830s when South Carolina also wanted to secede from the country during the Andrew Jackson administration.
Right. And to a lot of people that sport the Confederate flag, I really think that they're not ideological racists. I really believe that today. It's more of a Dukes of Hazzard, a you know, rebellious, don't tread on me sort of mentality.
Bubba Watson wants to put a U.S. flag on the General Lee. So
yeah, I get that, but I think to people's grandparents that lived in the 1940s, it wasn't about rebellion. It wasn't about this reckless youth spirit, boys will be boys, fraternity type stuff. It was a rallying cry for segregation. That was the genesis of it.
Yeah.
Now, am I offended when I watch the Dukes of Hazzard? Am I offended when I look at when I go to a Lynyrd Skynyrd concert? Not really. To sit there and say that flag was not about segregation, it wasn't really even about slavery, it was about segregation, is just not understanding the history. So it's about our history, it's about our heritage. No, it's not. It really isn't.
Well, I know we got off on a political, I'm sorry to take us down the political road, but
nice going, Joe.
Given the NCAA component, I thought it would be good to touch, and it also shows the fun summer months. And with the summer months, I would be remiss in not saying, as well stated, I know David has said this in the past, everybody's slate is clean. It is July. We're in the new academic year, so Duke, you are no longer national champion.
Right. Woohoo! Yeah.
Sadly, the same could be said for Virginia and their baseball team.
Yeah, but I'll take that. We only got a week to celebrate. That was I'll take that week.
So it's the 15-16 athletic year. Duke is now last year's national champions. We'll have a new one this year.
We at least are the defending national champions. You can always put the adjective defending, but you can't run around saying you're number one because you're not. Everybody's number one.
Right.
Well, with that, I really appreciate all those out there. Watch, and for David and John, thank you for tuning in, and we look forward in August. We'll probably start getting into some of the previews as rosters start to get solidified and decisions made. So I look forward to August and seeing all of you then.